Hello and welcome to episode 114 of the new and improved Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304, and I am also new and improved.
Oh yeah? How are you new and improved?
Well, I tell lies now.
You always did. If your critiques of our previous podcasts are anything to go by, you're always like, "Oh, I don't listen to anything I said previously."
That wasn't lying. Lying is when you're deliberately telling things wrong. I think that was just ignorance and stupidity.
Fair enough.
Which I feel are more innocent crimes, if no less forgivable.
Sure. Well, the only reason that I say it's new and improved is because thanks to Silver Spook, who we'll give a little shout out to, I am now recording this on a single PC and not having to do the little dance of recording on my laptop and worrying about aligning everything together. So thanks for the tip, Silver Spook.
You know what the best thing is that it didn't take 3 updates for your laptop.
Yeah.
I don't have to listen to you through a terrible laptop microphone, and we don't have to wait 26 minutes for your laptop to realize that it's got headphones plugged in.
That's true too. I mean, my laptop, to be fair, hasn't updated in a while, but that's beside the point.
It shows.
Yeah. Anyway, it's also our first podcast of the new year, so happy belated 2018.
Yeah, we're in a month in.
Yeah, and we're also recording on a new night, so many changes have...
Yeah, it's all different.
Along.
Instead of being your morning, it's my morning.
Exactly. So you're awake and I'm awake too, which is a nice change. Instead of it being your nighttime and my morning when neither of us are awake.
Yeah.
So there's a thing.
Normally it's like 1 in the morning for me when we record these, and now it's 7:30 in the morning, which is much better for me.
Yes, and it's 6:26 p.m. for me, which is much better for me. So look at that. It's like we're the stars of a children's book in which the problems we're having are simple solutions, and it takes us entirely too long to reach those solutions, but now we have, and now we're happier for it.
What cynical children's book have you been reading?
Big Dog, Little Dog, which I think is incredibly appropriate. Didn't I tell you about that book?
No.
Oh.
No. I'd clearly be the big dog.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically the story of you and me. It's big dog, it's a big dog and a little dog named Fred and Ted, and they're friends and they do all sorts of stuff, and like they go skiing and they do all this, like when they go skiing, Fred has the big skis and Ted has the little skis, and Fred drives a big car and Ted drives a little car and all that crap.
This is typical kids' book setup. There's not a lot of effort going into, like, sort of depth of plot here.
Oh, of course. No, it just establishes how they live their lives and how they accommodate for their various size issues.
Teaching kids about, like, basic purchasing of clothing and stuff, I guess.
Sure, I guess. So anyway, the conflict that happens when Fred and Ted decide to take a vacation together, and they're skiing or something, and they're like, oh, look, a small hotel. So they go to the hotel, and the person puts the big dog in the little room with the tiny bed, and they put in the, and they put the little dog in the big room with the big bed, and neither of them sleep very well. And
well, it's like Goldilocks.
Yeah, so like apparently you can only sleep well in a bed that suits your specific size. So they have a terrible night, and then the next morning they hang out and they walk around and they're like, oh, we should talk about our nights, and like they have this deep discussion about things, and then they're like, oh man, I didn't sleep well at all last night. My bed was too big and I couldn't feel comfortable, and then the other one's like, yeah, me too, my bed was too small. And then there's like a bird in a tree and he's like, hey, you idiots, why don't you just switch rooms? So they're like, oh, you're right, what a great idea. So then they run back to the hotel and they switch rooms and they sleep all day in the beds that are the right size. And then the bird says something like, oh, why make big problems out of little problems? Ha ha ha. And that's the moral of the story. So, that's a thing.
I got nothing to add. Except I once stayed the night in a YMCA accommodation with the smallest bed I've ever seen.
Really?
And I was, you know, I'm not short, and I thought, oh, this is going to be terrible, and I slept really, really well.
Well, good. You've just disproved the book's moral, which is fine. Anyway.
I think the book's moral is don't be stupid. Stupid dog. Don't let dogs book themselves on holidays. They can't handle the responsibility of organizing accommodation.
Clearly. Either that or the you know, stay at a hotel where the people, the staff are not stupid either, because the staff could have easily seen that they were... Anyway, that's beside the point. We've rambled long enough. Let's move on to our topic.
So this topic was a request.
It was a request. We got a lovely email from the equally lovely Jean-Baptiste de Clairfay, who is working on a game called Lancelot's Hangover. And he's a very lovely gentleman. And he wrote an email. He said... What's so funny?
This bed is too small for me.
That's your life right there.
Mm-hmm. That sure is, man.
Right. So he says, "Hey, Francisco and Ben," which I will add in for the moment. "I'm Jean-Baptiste from Lancelot's Hangover, and I hope you're doing well." "I am doing well, Jean-Baptiste. Thank you for identifying yourself in such a way. I have a suggestion for a next BCT podcast. How do you guys manage beta testing for adventure games? You talked a bit about this topic with Jacob Janerka in a previous podcast, but I think it might be interesting to a lot of fellow adventure game designers to talk about it in depth. From my own experience and what I've heard and read, the best way is to watch people play and observe them in silence and take notes. But this method looks like it has a lot of practical flaws. Those testers are very often friends and maybe don't want to hurt your feelings and give you too gentle or biased feedback about your games. Your friends may not be regular adventure game players, so their feedback could be very different from the targeted audience of your game. Sending games builds to fans, friends, or backers if you have been kickstarted seems like a good option, but you don't actually see them playing, and their feedback by email may also be biased or too friendly. From my own experience, asking people to capture their screen on video while playing the game, and talking while playing is very useful, but it might be difficult to ask people to dedicate several hours to test a non-polished and buggy build. Plus, maybe they don't want to be spoiled and enjoy the whole experience when the game is finished and shipped. If after tests you realize a set of puzzles don't really work, what do you do? Cut it and throw lots of assets and effort and time away? Or maybe fine-tune the difficulty by giving hints? So I think it could be a very interesting topic for a podcast, and I'm very curious to have your thoughts and experience about it. All the best, Jean-Baptiste." Well, thank you, Jean-Baptiste. There's a
lot of points to cover.
Yes, there are lots of points to cover. Yeah. So, yes, we did talk a little bit about this with Jacob, but we sort of glossed over. So, yeah, this is...
one of many things we discussed, yeah.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, we definitely have some things to go over here. So, I guess by going for his first point, his first point, really, is the whole watching people play your game. Now, you have beta tested several games of yours. How many of those have you actually beta tested watching people play?
I've watched a few people play my games, and I always find it a really interesting experience, because I think the thing it highlights best of anything is the little things that you thought were obvious, whether it be interface, whether it be puzzle cues, whether it be you have to look at an inventory item. The little things that you thought were very, very obvious. And it's really frustrating to watch someone completely miss that. And it's one of the most frustrating aspects of being a game designer, I think, is to just see something that you had taken for granted, and then you go, oh, now I've got to explain that.
Yes, I agree.
So I think that's probably the number one reason to do that, is to see if your fundamentals work right. Because stuff like puzzle feedback and stuff like that, in terms of, you know, this doesn't quite work, you can get pretty good from a written report, and, you know, typos and bugs and stuff like that. It's pretty easy for someone to take a screenshot of a graphical glitch and say, hey, this is wrong. But getting that sort of first impression approach to playing a scene there's nothing better than watching someone actually do it.
Yes, I agree. I haven't really watched too many people play my games, because I find it nerve-wracking and terrifying.
Yeah, it is.
But I definitely agree with that, because, yeah, it's absolutely true. Like, you know, beta testing isn't just for finding bugs. Beta testing is also for finding out if your story works, and if you're in an adventure game specifically, if your story works and if your just world works. Because if there's, like you said, yeah, I mean, if it's something that's obvious to you because it's obviously all in your head, may not be obvious to everybody else who plays.
Right. And something that Jean-Baptiste mentioned in his email is the idea of bias. And I want to mention that I think bias is a very good thing, and you should seek out testers with different biases.
Yes.
Some testers focus on the spelling errors and the bugs and the things like that. Some testers do not mention any spelling errors, and they'll play straight past the spelling errors, but say, hey, this story bit didn't make any sense. Why am I doing this? I don't understand why a character would do this.
Yes.
Some of them would say, you know, stuff specifically about puzzle design and, oh, I didn't get this, but maybe you could do this. So it's important to seek out those different sorts of testers. Some, you know, and I'm sure he meant bias in like, oh, they're biased towards liking you.
Right.
But it is important to get a bias of focus, you know, and a diverse range of testers for that very reason.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also to go towards that thing about bias. Yeah, I mean, like, there is a very real risk of if you get, like, you know, your mom to test your game. First of all, that's cool that your mom is testing your adventure game. But, of course, you know, being your mom, she's probably going to be like, oh, this is wonderful. Oh, I'm so proud of you, my little angel. Why don't you get a real job?
That is not what your mother
says. I know, I just wanted to... I just wanted to be stupid. Anyway,
I do recall the litmus test for one puzzle in Technobabylon being solvable is whether James's mother could solve it while drunk, I believe.
Oh my god. Which made me laugh. Well, there you go.
He figured if she could solve it while drunk, then anybody could solve it. That puzzle eventually got cut.
Oh, well, that's a shame. But as far as like your friends and stuff, like, yeah, it is a very real issue of your friends being biased towards like not wanting to hurt your feelings. But I think that, you know, if they're really your friends, they will give you an honest opinion and they won't hold back. I mean, I recall when you played a very early build of Lamplight City, you gave me some feedback that wasn't harsh. I mean, it was honest feedback. And, you know,
I think it depends on the person. For me personally, if I'm playing a friend's game, mm-hmm. I care more about improving that game than if I play someone else's game. I'm like, oh, I guess this is their thing. Usually with my friends, I know if they have like potential and I want to see them reach that potential. If I see something that I think sucks, I'll say it straight away. Because I'm like, well, I know you can do better than that. I believe that this is not your best work.
Right.
You know. And I also want to say when it comes to friends and testing, a lot of times your friends will be like, oh yeah, I'd love to play the game, I'd love to check it out.
Oh yeah, sure, and then they don't.
They're not looking to test the game, they're just excited about your project. So
yeah.
Friends are often not really the best people to have testing, just because...
Yeah.
Testing is work.
It's a job.
It's not just playing
it's
a game.
It's true.
It's not... And well, that's, you know, companies have
teams. They have dedicated QA people.
Yeah, so... Having your friends play a game and being like, oh, hey, I really liked it, or hey, I think this could be better is one thing.
Yeah.
But don't think that that is a substitute for genuine. Like, there are some people that are really good testers and they will pick on everything. And once you find one of those people, and this is what I always did, once you find one of those people, you ask them every single time because you know that they will give you super detailed feedback. They'll pick on stuff that you know you're not going to change, but there'll be some stuff within that you're like, oh man, I never even thought of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's another thing too that I think needs to be we need to address as well. Like if testers are gonna like they're going to offer their opinions because that's obviously what you're asking for. So don't think that. I mean, oftentimes they'll give very valid criticisms or very valid, they'll make valid points, but don't think that you have to fix every single little thing that they point out. I mean, just because one person points something out that they weren't particularly a fan of doesn't mean that everybody's going to feel the same way. So don't feel like, oh my God, one person didn't like this. I have to cut this entire puzzle sequence because one person didn't like it.
Yeah, there's obviously it's the same as everything. There has to be a point where you set a limit and a
Right.
boundary, you know. And if that's something, the
You,
best thing in that case is to get a second opinion, I think.
sure. Because I mean,
To
ultimately,
say,
knowing you can't please everybody all the time,
no.
so you can't figure that if you cut it, someone else is probably going to be upset that you cut it. So.
Yeah, and I've seen suggestions for things to be cut from games that I've worked on with like Wajedi. Of stuff that I really loved in the game, and I was like, "Oh no, we're not cutting that. I really love that bit. It's just that that particular person didn't find that funny or interesting or poignant or whatever.
Right.
It's just a personal preference thing." But at the same time, I also want to mention that like sometimes testers can come out pretty hard and swing at you pretty hard, and it feels like your months and months and months of work have been reduced to ashes in the
Yep.
space of a page.
I know that feeling
But
all too well.
it's important to remember that these people have put a lot of time in, they've put a lot of energy into giving you this stuff, and they're not just saying it to like be mean about your game. It's a lot of work to make a test report like that. And they obviously clearly believe in your game if they're giving you such a thorough thrashing. Like there's you can tell when someone's being an asshole usually. But you know, there's some points where it's gonna hurt your pride pretty bad because you see stuff and you're like, oh man, you know, I spent a month on that bit and it doesn't work. And it's not them just picking on you, it's them going, this does not match the rest of your game's potential, you know, or your previous work's potential or whatever, you know. And we've both seen that in the past and talked about it before, but I think it's an important thing to keep in mind that testing is work. It's a lot of work. And if someone gives you a really thorough detailed report, they're probably not trolling you. They're probably not just being an antagonist. They're probably really like, hey, I think this can be better than this, and I believe in your work. And, you know, pride's a hard thing to overcome. It really is. But yeah. But I noticed like I know I mean my learning process for art and for a lot of stuff was just to ask, well, you know, on the AGS forums on the Critics Lounge, I would ask for feedback, and at one point I was implementing every little bit of feedback I got, and then you learn after a while what is good feedback and what's bad feedback, and I think that's a skill too, is learning, like, you know, if you follow literally everyone's advice, first of all you'll have a very homogenized project and it'll just be like the air quotes ideal vision of something, but also you'll be like, you know, you run the risk of losing your personal input.
Absolutely.
Yeah, anyway, sorry, do
No,
continue.
it's fine. No, the next point that he brought up, which I thought is well, the whole thing's interesting. The other point he brought up was this one boring point he mentioned was, no, I'm kidding. The other thing he mentions here is about the ideal target, and if your friends are hardcore adventure game players or hardcore adventure game fans versus testing with people who are not used to adventure games. And that's an interesting point because most of the time in the early days when I would just get people to test the games, it didn't really matter because they were freeware games and they were going to be for the AGS community. And so they were tested by AGSers and it was fine because, you know, I had like maybe one or three or four, maybe five testers total. And it wasn't a big deal. But now with commercial games, it's different because obviously your fan base is different, your audience is different. And I mean, for the most part, you know, most adventure games are going to be played by the quote unquote traditionalists, hardcore adventure game fans. But if you're trying to reach a bigger audience, that's something to keep in mind. Like, I've been thinking about it myself, you know. I haven't done an enormous amount of testing so far, but like I've been saying for a while that, you know, I've wanted Lamplight City to sort of reach beyond just the standard hardcore adventure game fans and appeal more towards people who like detective games, because, you know, it's a detective game. So not necessarily branching into adventure versus casual, you know, or anything like that, but like I think it is important to get as many different eyes on the project as possible, including if you're trying to go for what I'm trying to go for, sort of thing.
Yeah, I think some of that's your intent, like some, your mission statement. If you want to make, you know, there's some games, like you're currently playing The Witness.
Right.
And
I am currently playing The Witness.
There's parts of The Witness that are going to put people off.
Mm-hmm.
But without those parts, the game would not be the same game.
Right.
You know, if you hate puzzles,
then why would you play The Witness?
Well, that's the thing. And you got to think, well, that's not my target audience. So you have to, I think, have an idea in mind of like, this is the entire scope of my target audience.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, design is hard enough without trying to appeal to everybody. And I mean, it's adventure games too. The format is just going to put some people off.
Of course.
You know, because they played adventure games in the 90s and were like, oh, these are terrible.
Yeah.
You know. It's just not for, not picking on the genre. I just mean that it's just not for some people. You know, I had friends that I tried to introduce to adventure games in high school, you know, and I'd give them like Beneath the Steel Sky and stuff. And some of them were like, oh man, this game is great. And some of them were like, you just click on stuff and walk around and they pick it up. I'm like, yeah, it's great. And then it's just not for them. You know, they think Zelda and Grand Theft Auto. So someone like that playing your game will be like, well, why didn't you make Zelda? You
right.
know? And you're just like, well, that's not really, it's, again, it's about constructive criticism. Something we always come back to, and every creative medium looking for feedback will always come back to, is constructive criticism is what you should seek.
Yes.
That's pretty basic advice, but that's all I got.
Yeah, fair enough. Sending the game's builds to fans, friends, or backers seems like a good option, but you don't actually see them playing and their feedback by email may also be biased or too friendly. So the thing too, I mean, this goes kind of back to what we were saying before about like people who are genuinely interested in playing through the entire game versus people who just want to try it out. Like, I don't want to knock or call out anybody, but like I've noticed that I've sent builds to a few people and very few of those people have either come back. Like, I did a pretty early round of testing a few months ago I asked for people to volunteer on Twitter, and I got, I want to say, about 7 or 8 people. And of those 7 or 8 people, I would say about 6 or 7 of them played the game to completion and gave good feedback. And after that, I've sent it out to a few people here and there, mostly people I know, and maybe like one has finished it. One person played it and said that they had a lot of feedback. They never gave it to me. Another person was like, oh, I'll play it, and then I never heard back. And I mean, you know, you don't want to nag. At the same time, you kind of have to here and there. But if... it kind of also is weird. It's in a weird position where, like, you know, if you're sending it to people who are your friends and they're just kind of, they've asked to play it, like, it's kind of weird to be nagging them if it's not their full-time job to be a QA tester, you know?
Right, yeah.
Like, they're basically doing you the favor of playing your game because they asked, or you asked them. So, like, to come after them and be like, hey, I need your bug reports, please. That's, you can't really expect to get away with that. So, yeah, there's that. But, think, like, yeah, well, go ahead.
Again, the main thing for quality testing and for detailed testing is to find a group of testers that will give you honest feedback and, you know, and ask them every time. If you get you get a group of people that will that hurt your feelings in a way that helps you improve the game, you know, I should say that wound your pride in a way that helps you improve the game, the other people you want to come back to, rather than friends that are like, oh yeah, I'm happy to take a look, you know. You want to find people that are comfortable not only spending the time to play through a game that's in an unfinished, you know, buggy state, because that's not as fun as playing the game when it's all finished and everything's snug as a bug and you just play.
Of course.
There's no problems. But also going...
Snug as a bug.
But also going, hey, you know, you can do a lot better than this in this area.
Right.
They're a rare find. They're the ones that once you find one of them, you hang on.
Yeah.
They're the good ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, like, some people just, I think, are less comfortable giving honest feedback, like, you know, friends and stuff like that. And some people may not be very good at articulating any points they have or know it feels kind of off. You know, it's funny, Dave will send me stuff to read over before he builds it in the game and stuff like that. And every now and then I'll have something that I'm like, oh, Dave, this doesn't feel quite right. And he's like, oh, I knew that that's not right. And I'm like, I can't tell you how to fix it. I can't, you know, but this is the bit that feels wrong to me. So it's not useful. And I think, too, a lot of the times, testers that try and offer solutions for stuff feel like they're cramping your style a bit. You're not looking for a solution all the time. Sometimes you're just looking for the problems.
Right.
And you're happy to implement and invent solutions yourself. It's just that sometimes it's hard to spot the problems in your work after 6 months of playing the same bit. You click through all the dialogue because you've left.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a couple of points in there that I was trying to make all at once. But, yeah, I did see something recently, and I forget who said it or where it was. It was probably on Twitter. But it was something like, you know, offer feedback if something doesn't feel right, but don't try and solve the problem. Allow the creative person to solve the problem themselves.
Right.
Because, you know, it's their work. Mm-hmm. And it's also kind of frustrating if you think you got a perfect solution. Unless you're a designer or a producer that's working on the project as part of the team, then that's a whole different thing.
Oh, of course, you know? Yeah.
And testing within a team is a different dynamic as well.
Yeah.
Because it's someone that has presumably shared the vision with you from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've made a misstep, maybe they can point that out to you.
Right.
But, you know, obviously our testing tends to be pretty intense compared to what we did on freeware stuff.
Yes.
It's much more, you know. But that's just how it is, you know. That's the sort of thing that you know that people in the Steam comments are going to be picking on and stuff in the... Whereas, you know, if you're doing freeware games, people are like, oh, great, I got a game for free. Who cares if this felt a bit wrong or something like that?
Oh, yeah,
so, yeah,
sure.
It's...
And that's why it's No, that's just why it's a big leap to go from freeware to people paid for this. But that's an entirely different topic that we've talked about before, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing for me about testing is how blind you can be to certain things in your game.
Yeah.
You know, and there's some points where I haven't noticed a thing in a game that I either did like or didn't like until someone wrote a review of it after the game had come out.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, you know what, I do really like that bit. And maybe, you know, it had been put in the game 8 months ago, so you don't think about that anymore.
Right.
You forget about it. Yeah, there's honestly stuff in games that I totally forget about, and I go through to do the commentary at the end, and I'm looking at everything, and I'm like, oh, geez, I forgot I did that. That's funny, or
yeah,
that's cool, or whatever. You know, and then there's other stuff that you read the review, and like, oh, man, how did we let that get in the game?
Mm.
So, you know.
Have you
it's
ever...
It's unfortunate that you can't just, you know, it's one of the other points that Jean-Baptiste brought up was about the puzzles.
Yeah.
If a puzzle sucks, do you just start from scratch? And it's unfortunate that talking of static from scratch, it's unfortunate that you can't release your game after it's been reviewed and fix all the problems. Reviewers are often people that are used to disassembling a game. You know, people like Richard Cobbett are good at breaking a game apart. This is why it works. This is why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it'd be great to be able to just have all that feedback before releasing a game.
I mean, technically you could go back and like patch your game, but that would be way too much work.
Yeah.
Unless it's just something that like is really terrible. Like I wanted to go back and patch a Golden Wake and fix the airplane puzzle, and I did. It just hasn't been updated.
Right. But yeah, that's the thing. Like, yeah, there are some games that came out to really, really bad reviews.
Yeah.
The developers took the time to fix those complaints. You know, maybe it was a few months' work, but they put the time in to fix those things.
Yeah.
Relaunched the game, and the sales improved. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a valid thing to do.
Sure. I mean, look at Batman, the PC port of Arkham Knight that was like super buggy, and people were really upset, and then they pulled it and fixed it and put it back up again later.
Yeah. And I mean, it's pretty common. Mass Effect Andromeda, they you know, did a whole thing. I remember even the original Witcher is the first game I think in my consciousness where I really remember it happening, was they did The Witcher, and you know, they got pretty mixed reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So then they did a free update as the enhanced edition, and that's when I started playing it, because magazines at the time, people were reading magazines including me, re-reviewed the game and were like, hey, this is the game it should have been. Right. Buy this.
Yeah. So, and I mean, look at even with like Thimbleweed Park, not that Thimbleweed Park got bad reviews, but like,
no.
Thimbleweed Park released the update that people criticized the fact that the characters didn't talk to each other, so they released an update with that feature.
I guess it goes to show it's never too late.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it is, but most of the time it's not.
I don't know. Honestly, don't know. Is there a case where you know that it's been too late and people have been unable to forgive, even if a developer is willing to fix it?
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of like, sometimes it's too late in that you find yourself in a position where you can't really update the game.
You're broke and you're just like, well, that's all my money gonna know about the game now.
Well, yeah, there's that too.
It's depressing.
I know it is. Anyway, that's the real reality of indie game life, though.
But yeah, I think in terms of cutting stuff, if something really sucks, I find personally that cutting something that doesn't work is a very freeing and liberating thing to do, and I really, really love cutting stuff.
I've come to realize that my biggest fear about cutting stuff is that I always worry that that just means that you're going to have a much shorter and crappier game as a result.
Well, I disagree.
Well, please tell me why. Enlighten me.
Because you're conflating shorter and crappier together. And they are totally different things. If you end up with a shorter game that flows better, your game is actually better overall.
Sure.
If you've got six like plates of food and two of them are terrible, your overall dieting experience is not very good. If you've got four plates of food, but they're all really good plates of food, your overall dieting
I'm hungry!
Well, that's your problem. Go buy another thing. But you know what I mean?
I do. I was just teasing.
Shorter does not mean crappier. Shorter probably means better. If you've got a 400-hour adventure game, I am never going to play it. There is no way I'm going to play it.
No, you're right.
If you got a 400-minute one, I'll give it a crack. I'll give it a go. You know, I'll give it a good old red-hot crack.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, I think it's important to remember that quality beats quantity every single time.
Okay.
That's probably wrong, and I'll probably regret saying that, and I welcome the feedback that I will get from all the listeners. That's fine. I am the one that makes the big, bold statements that upset everybody in this podcast, so why not start 2018 with another one? That's the commitment I bring to this Blue Cup Tools circus.
Good.
Arms are weird.
They are weird.
So, yeah, I think if you've got a puzzle that genuinely doesn't work, snip it out, get the big old choppy chops and just cut it out, or fix it. And when I mean fix, I mean fix it good and proper. Fix every single thing wrong with it. Don't half fix it and then go, oh yeah, we fixed it. That's not fixing it. It still probably sucks.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, curious about your opinion on as far as like sending it, who to send it to. What would you say is a good metric for, like, if you put out a call for testers because, you know, you're looking for people who will ideally offer everything we've talked about, you know, an honest critique of the game while, you know, being fair and or unbiased
and constructive
and constructive. And like, how do you know how to filter out the people who are serious versus the people who are just like fans who want to get an early sneak preview of the game?
Well, you filter them out when you're reading their report. I would say you lose nothing except your time by reading a report that doesn't tell you anything.
Right.
Everybody has the ability to point out something that you may have missed. Every single person. You know, and that in itself is valuable. You know, there's nothing that tells you from a person's response to a call for testers that'll tell you this is going to be the person that finds the thing that will have ruined the game. There's nothing that tells you. And like I say, the only thing that you really lose, apart from maybe one sale of a person that would have bought it instead of playing the beta, from giving yet another person access to your game to break it, is your time if the report that they send up ends up being useless. Everybody has the potential to be the one that points out the thing that would have ruined your game.
Right.
Because there's so many different things that can ruin a game, you know, and it takes forever to get rid of as many as possible. And then you're just like, well, we've run out of time. We've got to release. And there's still all these problems, but that's it. If I do any more, I'm going to cry. So, if you can get more eyes on your thing, there's more people spotting for stuff, you know, and they might be the one that does the really obscure thing that, you know, illegal exception
game. Whoops, crashes. You tried something that we weren't thinking of.
Yeah, and you know, anybody could be the person that does that really obscure thing that no one else has done, crashes your game, and the worst thing is game journalists are really good at finding those and putting it in the review of bugs that you never heard of. It's like, it's really important, I think, to just get as many people on your game as possible. Which, you know, obviously you can't like read 1,000 test reports.
Games journalists should also moonlight as beta testers, I think.
Well, some of them do. Some of them do.
Well, good.
That's just the thing. Like, it's very, there's a lot of combinations of elements possible in adventure games, and no tester can really challenge every single option in a game single-handedly. So, you know, having the one person that'll click on the flamingo 14 times is useful.
Yeah. I don't want to click on the flamingo 14 times.
Because it's boring, but some people do it, and you're like, and then when they report to you, you're like, why the hell did you click on the flamingo 14 times? And you're like, well, I gotta fix it, you know, because yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, and you know, there's always bugs that come out after a game is launched, because all of a sudden you've gone from 30 people with their hands on your game to, you know, over 1,000 people, and they're doing all the weird stuff that nobody in the testing thing did. So get them on the game early. Get them looking at it.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, the ones that are willing to do it, you know. I'll be honest, like, if people ask me, like, hey, do you want to play an early build of my game? I'm like, no. Because, first of all, if I'm beta testing something, there's this burden of, you know, I now have this task that I promised something that I would do. Beta testing isn't fun.
Nah.
I'm just going to put that
out. It's really not.
It's really, really boring. It's super, super boring, and it's work. And if you've been working on your game all day, the last thing you want to do when you hang up the you know, mouse, or hang up the Wacom pen and get yourself a cup of tea and wind down from work is take down more notes of stuff that you're like, oh, that doesn't work. It's not very, it's a lot of effort, as I said before, you know. So if someone's like, oh, hey, do you want to play an early build of my game? I'm like, can I just play the finished thing when it's fun? Because I like fun games. No. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I see early access and stuff like that. I'm like, why would I want to play another beta? I play too many for work.
Early access, yeah. Early access is weird because it definitely depends on the style of game. Like, early access is not for adventure games.
Yeah,
it's really. But yeah, not. I mean, if it's like a multiplayer thing, then sure. But yeah. But we're talking about adventure games. Gosh darn it! So,
I guess.
Screw early access.
But yeah, that's like that's something important to remember that it like if someone comes on and is like, oh hey, I'd love to play your game.
Yeah,
they're not looking to play. A thing to be like, hey, this is how you can improve it because they're interested in design.
Right.
Because a lot of people, a lot of times the people that are testers are really interested in design, you know.
Well,
Sebastian that used to help me with games a fair bit back in my sort of early start on making games got a job as a professional tester at a games, and he was working on like games for EA and Ubisoft and stuff like that, you know. It was a genuine testing firm and he hated it because if he played a build of my game, he'd have all these suggestions. I'd be like, oh man, that's really good advice. You know, let's try that. Or yeah, that's just wild enough to work. We'd try all this crazy stuff. EA don't want that. They don't want some guy in Spain to tell them how to fix their game. They want to know the bugs.
Right.
They got a whole team of designers sitting around the table going, this doesn't work, that doesn't work. Some guy in Spain isn't going to fix anything for them, you know, to their opinion. So he found it really, really frustrating because all they wanted was the bugs. That's all they wanted, you know. So, but yeah, you get these people like him that are really interested in design and aren't good at running a project by themselves. Or, you know, or writing up a design document by themselves, but are interested in fixing problems in design where they're like, oh, you know, identifying issues that you might not have thought of. So, yeah, whereas to me, all of my energy is gone by the time I've worked on stuff for Dave or whoever I'm working with at that point. I'm like, I get to the end of the day, I'm like, I got no energy to give to anyone else, you know? That's it. I've done my bit, you know, and I'm happy to play adventure games once they're done.
Yeah.
And I don't have to, and I'd be like, hey, this is why your game's broken times 30. I used to really love it when I was like, I used to really, really like it. And I remember like sending Josh pretty copious amounts of notes for early Gemini Rue and stuff like that. And I was like, well, here's a 3,000 word essay on why your game can be fixed, and now I'm just like,
but then you became jaded.
Not jaded, just just weary. Just you know, I put, when you're building big games yourself, that's a lot of energy.
Oh yeah, sure. So, sure. I
totally lost track of what we were talking about.
Yeah, I was gonna address another point, but I got distracted because I was in the middle of actually sending a bill to somebody of music.
Right. Yeah.
Appropriately enough. I was gonna ask you, if did I already ask you this, have you watched someone take a video and talk over the video?
No, I've only ever seen people do it like live. I've never seen anyone like record a video of themselves playing, then narrate the recording,
yeah,
and then send it to me.
Actually just experienced that for the first time recently, and it was really interesting.
Did they narrate it after they played it?
They narrated it as they were playing it.
Oh yeah, no, I've seen that.
Yeah,
yeah.
People have done that for your games.
Yeah, and it's like I said, it's a great way to get the intuitive stuff.
Yeah, sure. And it actually helped a lot because it actually helped me tutorialize the prologue.
That's exactly what it's good at. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly what that sort of thing is good at, where you expect people to grok is the common term now.
Sure.
Something. And
I mean, yeah.
They just do not.
Right. I've mostly like, I've seen people, the whole like showing it at expos at Playcrafting here in New York has been my main sort of, you know, look and watch people play in silence experience. But that's only been the prologue, and this person who tested it tested as far as like they finished the first case, which helps. Right. But like they were playing through the prologue and they were just like out loud thinking out loud and commenting out loud and were like, oh man, I wish that this that it would tell me like that I could do this or that I knew that I could do this. And I was like, you know what, that's a fair point. Let me write this down. And so I wrote down all the stuff that I saw they were struggling with, and that helped me realize what I needed to add and what I needed to fix. And yeah, it was really helpful.
There's times in the past where I know that we've shared screens over Skype. I've played through something of yours and I've shared my screen and you can watch me play, and obviously we have audio.
So, yeah, and we use that audio to be like, oh, hi, Amy!
Well, yeah, but, like, but also, you know, you can get, like, up-to-date, like...
Sure.
Like, this is why I'm frustrated. This is why I'm stuck, right. You know? Right. And I often find people who send... If you're... In the case where you're working with someone on something, you know, if Dave sends me something, if he sends me a build... Usually I try and pay attention to what he's specifically looking for feedback on.
Oh, yeah.
There'll be a bit that he's looking for feedback on. And if someone sends you a build and you play it and like, oh, yeah, that works, and that's all you give them, that's not the feedback they're after. They want to know about a specific bit. So usually I try and focus on that bit. Like before going in, I'll be like, all right, what does the designer want me to pay attention to?
Right. That's one of the, that was actually the point that I was... that I had forgotten about. One of the most important things I think as a beta tester that you can ask a designer, and I think I appreciate it whenever testers ask me this, is what is it you're looking for feedback on? Because that way you can focus specifically if there's something as the designer that you are, that you really want, like if there's a particular scene that you want to know if it has the right emotional impact that you're going for, or if there's a story beat that you're not quite sure about. Like, you know, you want to make sure that the player feels the right emotions at that time too. And not to harp on emotions, let's not be David Cage here. But, you know, just like, or, you know, my main thing, like every time someone has asked me lately, obviously I say, well, you know, I want to, first and foremost, I want to make sure that the game doesn't crash. So like, if you find any game breaking bugs, please note those. But also, I'm mostly interested in, is the game fun? Can you relate to the characters? Like, are they interesting? Are they people that you, you know, that you enjoy interacting with? And basically that, like, is it fun? Like, does it feel like
worst thing is,
good game that you're playing?
The worst thing is that's the hardest feedback to...
Yeah.
Vocalize, I think.
Yeah.
If you're not enjoying something, sometimes it's hard to say why.
Yeah.
You know, there's games that I know are good games or well-designed games that I just can't get into, and I'm like, I don't even know why sometimes.
Sure.
You know, and I actually find it quite an interesting challenge to try and analyze why I don't get into certain things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, I've experienced it too. I mean, there's plenty of... There's games that, like, everyone's like, oh, this game's great, and I'm just like, I don't really... It's not for me. But that's...
Unfortunately, I find that I'm stubborn enough that in the process of trying to discover why I dislike a game, I usually end up liking it and then completing it. That's what happens to me all the time.
Well, you have more patience than most people, I think.
Well, but... it's interesting to me, like, you know, if I, like, recently I was playing Might and Magic 7, and I was, like, playing it and I'm going, you know, oh, this is... there's got all these problems and it's got all this and it's got all this, and then I, you know, I'm 7 hours and 3 dungeons in and I'm like, you know,
that's already a pretty big commitment. I mean, at
it's
that
three
point
in the morning and I'm like, I really like this game.
Yeah, if you've already committed at that point to so many hours, I think you're pretty much guaranteed to continue playing the game, just saying.
No, not at all, because computer role-playing games especially have difficulty spikes that just come up to you in the middle of the game.
Yeah,
it happens all the time.
I guess that, yeah.
And you're just like, it's like, oh, this is impossible. And some games, like Might and Magic 6, I stuck through the difficulty spikes. And the difficulty spikes in Might and Magic 6 are wild. Absolutely wild, you know. But, like, But you're like, I guess I'm a very stubborn person.
Well, that you are a very stubborn person.
It's true.
But that's fine, because like, I'm a stubborn person too, but not for CRPGs.
Well, CRPGs take up so much time and so much energy, and I find them so compelling that I often try and pick ones that I don't think I'll like, just so I don't have to finish another goddamn 60-hour game. And then I
why do you even bother playing them at all? There's a very easy solution to that.
Because when you're curious about something, you just want to try it for an hour and be like, you're like, all right, well, I didn't like that so far. It's a sweet release. Unfortunately, most of the time, I mean, I've already finished 2 CRPGs this year, and I'm working on my third.
Oh, dear God.
And I'm like, oh, I wish I didn't like these games so much. I genuinely started playing Dark Sun Shattered Lands so that I wouldn't have to play another Might and Magic game, which I knew I would like, and finish.
Oh, my God.
And guess what? I ended up liking Dark Sun's Shattered Lands and finishing the damn game. Even though literally everyone on my Twitter told me that the final battle is impossible.
And was it?
You just have to be good at strategizing with AD&D 2.5 edition spell or 2 edition second edition spells. And I've been doing that since Baldur's Gate. That's literally been my whole life. That's all I've ever done.
Wow.
That's all I'm good for.
Oh dear.
And I was like, this game's too easy until the final battle. And I'm like, oh, finally, this game's hard. Anyway, let's talk about something that's not me and Baldur's Gate.
Yes, please.
It's not the Baldur's Gate podcast. Yes.
It never will be. There's already a Baldur's Gate podcast, and it's not this
there
one.
There is, Mages and Murder Duds.
Yes. Anyway, so we talked about that. We talked about the puzzles. I think we've covered everything that Jean-Baptiste asked for. What?
Yeah. I mean, I really don't have that much more to say about testing. Yeah. It's just one of those topics that you're like, well, that's the long and short of it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of little stuff, you know? You could talk forever about organized way to do testings and, like, the best forms to give feedback in that. But they're the sort of examples that are best to have written examples for.
How much would you say... I got a question for you. How much would you say is not enough testing?
Well, how much would you say? Or, it's obviously something you've considered.
Well, I mean, I just wonder because, like, as I said, like, with Lamplight City, personally, I've had a few people play it, but... I've had very few people of those people play it to completion, and it's a game, it's actually one of the games that I've worked on that I've tested the least, like, because with Shardlight we had people like the first like organized, you know, forum test that we did was the beginning of the game up until I believe either the Ministry of Medicine, or maybe I'm confusing that with like the preview that we sent out to journalists, but it was either there or it cut off at the point where Amy escapes from the torture scene and like the Reaper comes and shows up for the first time. I think that's actually where it ended.
We regularly test in chapters.
Yeah.
You get to a point where you're like, that's a sensible breaking point, you know,
right.
Or acts, I guess. The first act of the game, you're like, all right, let's test this first act. Make sure that's polished up while we're putting together the second act.
Right.
The second chapter, or whatever you want to call them. The testers are finding all the bugs and problems like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just a smart way of doing it. Otherwise, you know, especially a game like Techno Babylon, you'd have 13 chapters to test at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
It just sucks.
Yeah.
It's just not fun at all. So you get it tested early, and then you're not dealing with 4,000 bugs.
Right.
You're dealing with...
I think it also depends, too, because, like, yeah, if you test stuff early, if you get, like, the bug stuff taken care of, and you test stuff that... you test stuff that can easily lead to bugs, and you fix those and you squash those early, and you don't have to worry about those later on.
Yeah, and then, something
because like I mean
can come back and bite you.
Oh yeah, definitely something, and then new things can come up too. Like I've noticed that with newer versions that I've sent out, where I've like updated the sprites and like you know imported the actual final art of sprites instead of the placeholder ones. You take for granted that they have speech views, and the game crashes because it's calling a speech view that you know, wasn't a problem before because you only had one thing. Anyway, stuff like that. But
dumb little stuff.
Yeah, that you don't dumb think. Stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no.
But what
there's
I was
been times where Dave has sent me a build for feedback, or where probably even you sent me a build for feedback, and I try to play to the bit, but because of like chapter skipping or they've control X to the scene or something like that, I'm like, I literally cannot access this thing without doing a very specific form of playing for this scene. Otherwise the game just crashes because you didn't think of something very basic.
Yeah. So, but like, but with Lamplight City, for example, like, you know, in the early days when I was doing like the chapter by chapter tests and I only had like, you know, I was only up to like, you know, the second or the third case implemented, I was sending Dave builds and Dave came back to me with feedback. And so like I worked on his feedback. And then after that, I just sort of finished the game before I sent out even more, because I was just like, well, I mean, I'll have time for testing later and I'll just, you know, whatever. I'll work on finishing the game first. So like the second sort of real big round of testing has been after the game has been finished. So it was sort of like my first thing was just feedback from Dave when it was halfway done, and then feedback from everyone else when it was completely done. So, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like, well, you know, there's really, if there's any changes that are required, it's going to be pretty significant changes. So I'm kind of just, I don't know.
I think that's one of the reasons why prototyping is so good with very rough stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to get feedback on a bit, you haven't spent any time making animations. You haven't spent any time making backgrounds. You just send the rough bit and, you know.
Yeah.
And I always say to Dave, like, if you can get an emotional responses with stick figures, then once the graphics are in, you know it works.
Yeah. I mean, in like you say, yeah, it's important to prototype. Like, yeah, I mean, basically, you know, for something like my game, you know, if it's, it doesn't, like the core gameplay is what is important and what needs to be interesting. And I feel like, you know, in testing it early, like with between the stuff that you told me and the stuff that Dave told me, there were things that needed fixing that were easy to fix it early on, you know, where like, you know, the characters don't, you know, they talk too much and they don't actually say anything, or like, you know, do more discovery gameplay rather than being told stuff, that sort of thing. And
I also think like it's interesting. I remember very early on, it's not even really testing, but Dave will do the same thing. You just like explained a bit to me.
Right.
And I'd be like, oh dude, that doesn't work at all. You know?
Right.
And that's not really testing, but it's the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you can, I mean, there's cases that you cut completely, basically, I believe.
There was one case that I merged into one pretty early on. And then I switched the order of two of them based on feedback as well. If you're talking to me, if you're referring to the monkey case, yes.
Yeah,
that was some elements of that were taken and put into another one.
Right, but I remember like you explaining the crime to me. I'm like, literally none of this makes any sense. You
right,
know? And
right.
If you can catch it, then
sure. And that was one of the advantages too in the particular case of the fact that it's a mystery game with standalone cases. Like you can prototype without even building the cases. You just, you know, write them up as mysteries and you get people to, I had you like guess stuff and ask me questions and like sort of do like a little proto investigation thing. And that was a good way to work that stuff out.
But so, even like Dave will write the dialogue of a scene out and I'll read it. You know, he recently wrote one out and sent it to me, and I read it, and then I was just ticking it over in my head, and I'm like, oh, let me just clarify this.
Mm-hmm.
And when I clarify, I'm like, oh, that really doesn't work at all. He's like, oh, yeah, someone else has said the same thing. So before you've even got it out of a notepad document into the AGS or the engine of your choice.
That's my big flaw that I need to rectify is that I don't write my game dialogue outside of AGS. I need to start doing that and get it refined.
It makes it easy to send to people.
It's true.
But yeah, that's one of the things that, like, if you can catch it before you've even built it,
yeah,
you know, because sometimes it's easier to pick up on stuff when you're not being distracted by graphics, you know, because a lot of times, unfortunately, if I'm playing a build, I'm looking to see what I need to fix from my work.
Right.
As well, you know, because it's very different when you're giving someone art and they put it in the game. If I do art myself, if I'm doing an animation, when I've got it roughed out, I'll put it in the game and I'll code it in and I'll make it happen. I'm like, oh no, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if I don't have a build of the game, I can't do that. So I, you know, I'll do an animation, send it off, and I hope it's fine. And then 3 months later, I see it in the game and I'm like, oh man, it doesn't work at all. You know, and by that point, the whole scene may be programmed, coded up to the point where it's like, we don't want to go back and touch that. And you, So I'm usually looking for stuff on my end to be like, what do I need to fix? Or, you know, what's animations playing too fast? Usually most of them, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like.
But I think too that, like, yeah, catching that stuff really helps too, because especially if you have a game where you have like a core mechanic that doesn't necessarily work, if you can fix it and then going forward it'll make the rest of the design easier. Like, just as an example of what I said, like, you pointed out that the characters tended to, you know, be basically fact lists, and they were right. So, like, improving that in the first case meant that going forward designing all the rest of the game, that was something to keep in mind. So it wasn't so much that, you know, I had to, like, it was a good thing to catch early, because if it had been, you know, the whole game is designed and written at that point, then it would just be a huge greater undertaking to fix that later on. So, you know, something like that is good to have to catch early.
I agree.
Yes. Good. I'm glad you agree. I think we've pretty much covered it all.
I've pretty much said everything I can say about testing. At one point, a while ago, you asked me how much testing do I think is too much or enough.
Not enough, I said. I don't think there's too much. There's such a thing as too much testing.
Well, that's the thing. I think that testing's a bit like, you know, violin practice, is you can never really do too much.
Right.
You know, so if you've got people testing the game, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say there's no point. It's like art practice or whatever. There's no point where you're like, oh, man, I've practiced this too much and it's getting worse because of this.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you can't. You probably can't get worse at physics by studying it more.
I mean, I can. The only way that I could think that that might apply towards testing is if you know, you get all this feedback and, like, you start obsessing over every little tiny nitpick and you're like, oh my god, I need to do this. And then, you know, it's like too many cooks spoil the broth type thing.
But that's not testing being the issue. That's your approach to the feedback, I think.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I think there's really no point at which you can have too many people there's no point at which you've been like, oh, this game has been tested too much. It's too polished. This game's too polished. I can't take
it. I'm blind. It's so shiny.
I really cannot envision reaching that point because
there's
stuff that we all know. You'll see a game that you made 4 years ago and you're like, oh man, why didn't I fix that? That's the worst feeling. So don't let yourself, you know, try and minimize that as much as you can. That being said, like, I'm at the end of a project and being because, you know, I finally figured out how to make this project, so I'm ready to start. Anyway.
Yeah.
Woe is me, etc.
Wow, boo-hoo-hoo, etc. Yes. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, thanks for listening. This has been our episode.
Thank you for the topic suggestion. Happy New Year to everybody.
Thanks, Jean-Baptiste. If you have any topic suggestions, feel free to email us or post in the thread in the Blue Cup Tools AGS forums thread. I think there's a couple of topics in there that we haven't gotten to yet. I need to scour there.
Because they're not very interesting.
Oh. What a rude...
And they're not appreciated.
Jesus. Yeah. Anyway, yes, if you want to find us on Twitter, I am at Grunislav Games.
Yes, you are.
Are you still anti-Twitter?
I'm not anti-Twitter. I just don't think I'm very interesting.
Okay. Well, you're at Ben_304, and together
we are
at BCT_podcast. And look, now that we're on the same thing, that'll actually be in sync. So
I highly doubt that.
Oh, it will be. Anyway.
Okay.
Bye.